Have you tried to be in touch with him since? Have you tried to tell him, Mr. Hughes, come forward and say...
I've said, Howard, speak up. Call off the dogs. I've written him a letter to the only address that I have at the moment that I know is valid, and I've used the correct code words for identification. And if he gets that letter, which apparently he hasn't so far, I presume he will surface.
To jaywalk in Rome, you must have the steel nerves of a toreador. You must believe drivers are more afraid of killing you than you of dying.
I'm Morley Safer. I'm Mike Wallace. Those stories and more tonight on 60 Minutes. First, in addition to the Dallas Cowboys' win in the Super Bowl, these headline items. The Nixon administration backed off its tough stand on food stamps for the needy. Under pressure from governors, mayors, and Congress, Agriculture Secretary Butts announced a switch back to the liberal food stamp policies of the past. Democrat candidate Muskie of Maine says that he's not sure he would offer amnesty to Vietnam draft resistors. The senator shows a commanding lead in a CBS News poll of projected delegate strength among Democrat contenders. Details of that poll coming up. And Howard Hughes biographer Clifford Irving quotes Mr. Hughes as saying that former Defense Secretary Clark Clifford was the man who asked Hughes for a $205,000 loan for Richard Nixon's brother. Clark Clifford denies it. That story when 60 Minutes continues.
Hi, honey.
Hello, sweetheart. So they wouldn't fix the javelin today, huh?
No, it's fixed.
Radio goes on the blink. You got to take it back tomorrow, right?
It's fixed, honey.
I know. The same old runaround. Two big parts, fortune for labor. All right. When do we get the bill?
Honey. It was free.
I'm going to take the day off tomorrow. You should never go down there alone.
Jonathan, what would I ever do without you?
I don't know, sweetheart.
American Motors Buyer Protection Plan. If we weren't building them better, we couldn't back them better.
To her husband, kids, and dog, Peggy's the Rock of Gibraltar. Tonight, she's down with a cold.
I've got it bad, Sam. Got a stuffy nose, scratchy throat. Been coughing, feel achy. I need some rest.
Here, Peg. Take NyQuil.
Vicks NyQuil nighttime cold medicine relieves your major cold symptoms for hours, so it lets you get the rest you need.
It's nice to be cared for.
You got a cold tonight? Put NyQuil to work.
Whenever you're driving and wherever you're bound, on freeways and byways, the country round, you'll feel better knowing anytime, anywhere, that like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Isamu Kanashiki makes a career out of helping people in Waipahu, Hawaii. He's one of more than 10,000 State Farm agents throughout the country who provide personal attention to every family insurance need. He can help you too if you live in Waipahu. If you live somewhere else, just check your local Yellow Pages.
And like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
McGraw-Hill, the publisher, has paid Howard Hughes $750,000 for the rights to his autobiography. And a voice purported to be that of Howard Hughes has insisted the alleged autobiography is a fake. That is the nub of the controversy that has swirled this past week around Hughes, Clifford Irving, the author who claims to have assembled the book with Hughes' help, and McGraw-Hill, the publisher. The author, Clifford Irving, says the voice on the telephone a week ago was not Howard Hughes. Irving says the man on the phone made several errors of fact, and that besides, Hughes couldn't sit through a 2.5-hour phone conversation without several long intervals because of his physical condition. Well, Irving doesn't stop there. He has produced two letters, allegedly handwritten to him by Howard Hughes, authorizing him to proceed with the biography. We'll put those letters on camera for you in a moment. Handwriting experts certify that it is indeed Hughes' handwriting. And Irving says that he met with Hughes many times over many months in Mexico, Puerto Rico, Florida, and the Bahamas to tape the reminiscences that formed the book. I met with Clifford Irving at the home of his attorney, Martin Ackerman. There, he gave me the manuscript of the autobiography to read, full of intimate detail of Hugh's life from his birth 66 years ago to 1971. And there, Irving showed me the contracts between him and Hughes. The one you are looking at signed, he said, in Florida on September 10th, 1971.
This is the letter that really got things underway, Mr. Irving.
That's right.
Dear Mr. Irving, I thank you again for the pleasantness of your letter to me. I would be grateful if you would let me know when and how you would wish to undertake the writing of the biography you proposed. I wish there to be no publicity about this communication for the time being, and I would view a breach of this request very unfavorably. Sincerely yours, Howard Hughes. You have there a letter, I believe, to you from Hughes saying, go ahead now.
That's the final authorization.
Yeah,
I've got that.
What's the date on that?
9-11-71. This is Xerox.
This is a Xerox. Clifford Irving, I have read and understood the terms and conditions of your contract with McGraw-Hill dated 3-23-71. I authorize McGraw-Hill to publish my autobiography from the manuscript in your possession according to the terms and conditions of my letter of agreement with you dated 3-4-71 and the letter of addendum to that agreement dated 9-11-71. This, I suppose, has to do with money. Howard Hughes is being paid.
Oh, yes, he's being paid. He has been paid.
He's already been paid. Those checks have been cashed.
Checks have been cashed with bank-documented signatures.
Swiss bank.
No, as far as I know, as well as the Swiss bank, Chase Manhattan Bank has said on the back of the check, signature guaranteed. Endorsement guaranteed.
What I find difficult to understand, Mr. Irving, is why Howard Hughes wants money for publishing something that he is so anxious to get out on the public record. After all, he has $2 or $3 or $6 billion. Why does he need a paltry few hundred thousand more?
Well, the actual figure of his holdings, as he told it to me, is $2.3 billion, but it's more than that. The man's life story is worth something to him. Howard Hughes did not get to be a billionaire by giving things away for nothing. He has a certain pride. He feels, I'm worth this much, and that's what I want. And he asked for it, and he got it.
Were there any witnesses to your meetings with Howard Hughes?
Yes,
any other human beings?
Yes, there were.
Who?
A researcher.
By name?
A man named Richard Susskind.
And how?
Who accidentally happened to be sitting with me in a room when Hughes arrived too early. Susskind stood there. Hughes stood there. I stood there. And finally, I said, Dick Susskind, who's doing some research for me on a project. And Hughes said, I suppose you know who I am. Susskind, unfortunately, instead of taking that opportunity to slip out of the room, said, yes, I do, Mr. Hughes. How do you do? He started to stick out his hand and withdrew it instantly because Hughes is not very keen on shaking hands. And then, after another moment of awkward silence, Hughes reached into his pocket and pulled out a bag. We still disagree. I say it was a cellophane bag. Susskind says it was a paper bag. And he said to Dick Susskind, have a prune. And Susskind took a prune and said, this is an organic prune, isn't it? Hughes said, yes, yes. How did you know? He said, this is the only kind I eat, though all the rest are poison. And then they were off and running on a discussion of organic foods and vitamins and whatnot while I stood there like a dummy.
If he's such a sick man, what in the world is he flying around the Western Hemisphere meeting you in all of these assorted places for?
Who said he was such a sick man?
Well, you say that he's so sick that he couldn't stay through a more than 20 minutes in a taping session.
I said it was physically impossible for him to talk for 2.5 hours without long breaks. That doesn't mean that the man can't travel. When you travel, you don't talk.
Well, what was the necessity of traveling if he's in that kind of shape? Why couldn't you simply come to Nassau, to the Britannia Hotel, go upstairs, and that's it?
Well, he likes to travel. And also, at the very beginning, the specific arrangement between Mr. Hughes and myself was this. He said to me, none of my people in my organization know about this, and none of them are going to know.
Why?
Because there are certain things he has said that perhaps he thought they would disapprove of and raise a little ruckus.
And isn't...
In any case, it was his private business. He is a very private man. His communication with his organization is sporadic. As you undoubtedly know, the executive vice president of Hughes Tool Company and Howard Hughes' chief counsel and the man who represents him in Nevada, Chester Davis, has never met Howard Hughes in his life. And as far as Mr. Hughes is concerned, never will.
Because?
Because Mr. Hughes doesn't want to meet him.
I don't think he likes...
He's not interested.
I don't think he likes Davis from reading your book.
Well, he may not like him.
Well, then why does he employ him?
Maybe he's a good lawyer.
But he really doesn't like him. Again, that's the impression I get from reading your book.
You're referring to the transcripts, Mike, not the book.
Oh. You mean it wasn't included in the book?
At Mr. Hughes's request, certain things were taken out of the book.
You didn't take out the stuff about Mayhew in the book?
Oh, no, I didn't, because he said, I want that in.
He doesn't like Mayhew, he doesn't like Davis, but Davis is not in the book, Mayhew is in the book. Why?
Well, Davis is mentioned in the book.
Well, I know, but I mean the real Hughes feeling about...
Well, you see, Hughes fired Mayhew. And there is now contention in the Nevada courts by Mayhew as to whether or not he was fired. And Hughes wants it made very clear that he did, in fact, fire Robert Mayhew, and that Chester Davis and Bill Gade do represent his interests in the state of Nevada.
In the manuscript of the autobiography that Clifford Irving gave me to read, Howard Hughes is quoted as saying that bribery and favors are at the root of the American political system. In that context, I asked Irving about the background of the Hughes Tool Company loan to Richard Nixon's brother Donald in 1956.
The background of that one and the full story is told by Hughes in the autobiography. I think I can tell you this much now without stealing Howard Hughes' thunder. As you know, $205,000 was loaned to Richard Nixon's brother, Don Nixon, who Hughes says was running a joint in California that served Nixon burgers. And Hughes also remarked that he would have done better off working for the Salvation Army or any other nonprofit organization. Mr. Hughes was asked for the money.
By whom?
By a representative.
Who?
That's Mr. Hughes' story, Mike.
Clark Clifford?
That's what Mr. Hughes says.
Okay. What was the quid pro quo for the $205,000? Why would Howard Hughes lend Richard Nixon's brother $205,000 for some Nixon burgers?
The quid pro quo is described in the book.
The reason I ask you that is it comes back to the word fixer. Something was
fixed.
And
I'm not going to call Howard Hughes a fixer. I call him a man who makes very careful arrangements to see that he gets what he wants.
The loan, Irving says Hughes told him, has never been repaid. Clark Clifford told me there is not a grain of truth in the allegation that he had anything to do with the Hughes Tool Company loan to Donald Nixon. He acknowledged, however, that his law firm has represented the Hughes Tool Company since 1950. In his younger days, Hughes developed a reputation as a ladies' man. I asked Irving about that.
Well, he's known them all. You know, Ava Gardner, Linda Darnell, Katherine Hepburn.
I wasn't sure from reading the book whether his relationship with Miss Hepburn was an affair of the heart or an affair of the head, if you will.
I think it was an affair of the heart and the head. He's very respectful of Katherine Hepburn. He liked her very much. He said she was a very clean woman, used to bathe 3 or 4 times a day, and she always told me that I was divine. He said, and I kind of like that.
I understand he has a kind of a classification system for the human beings with whom he comes in contact.
Yes, you see, he had a system. I'm not sure if he employs it anymore. There was a whole file card, and all his friends and associates, anyone who might fly on his planes or meet him, had a classification, A, B, C, D. And that ranged from filthy, moderately dirty, and moderately clean.
One hears the stories that he's, you know, long hair and long fingernails and a pretty decrepit-looking person himself.
This is nonsense.
When you last saw him, what did he look like?
Hughes is a man Almost as tall as I am, 6'3".
Weighs?
Under 140 pounds.
Is he a good-looking man, still?
He has the good looks of a man who once was extremely handsome and has dignity in his face.
Does he wear a beard?
Not a real one.
Not a real one.
What I mean is he has on occasion worn false beards and false mustaches and wigs.
With you?
Mike, I said there's a James Bond set up here that's out of the worst possible detective novel you could ever read.
Well, no, he wears beards and wigs and disguises.
Well, he doesn't wear them in my presence, but he takes them off when he arrives. But he's worn them.
Just so people would
When I met him the second time in Puerto Rico, he had suddenly grown a full head of hair. And I said, what's that? He said, oh, that's a wig. I bought it in the five and dime. It cost me $9.95. He says, I have to watch out. He says, there are people always looking for me. And there's a price on my head. So he uses these disguises.
Do I understand that he has some kind of a double who has the same symptoms that he has?
He did, for a time, have a man who was, he said, like the fool at the Sultan's table. Tried out the medicines that he had to take.
Why?
Well, it's a bit extreme. And I suppose he was afraid at that particular time that there were certain people who would like to see him out of the way. At least that's his story.
Irving says the last time he saw Howard Hughes was on December 7th. Since that time, a voice purported to be that of Howard Hughes has told reporters that he doesn't know Irving, and that the whole business of the so-called autobiography is a fraud.
Have you tried to be in touch with him since? Have you tried to tell him, Mr. Hughes, come forward and say...
I've said, Howard, speak up. Call off the dogs. I've written him a letter to the only address that I have at the moment that I know is valid, and I've used the correct code words for identification. And if he gets that letter, which apparently he hasn't so far... I presume he will surface. I don't know why he hasn't surfaced. It puzzles me, it upsets me, it distresses me. And I don't mean on my own account, because I can handle this, and we have the proof, and that's no problem. It just distresses me that he seems unable to respond.
There's no doubt in your mind that he's alive, is there?
No, I assume he's alive.
Is the autobiography genuine? I can only say that it is laced with detail that one would think that only Howard Hughes could know. Did Clifford Irving meet with Hughes and tape 30 hours of conversation with him? Or did he come upon the material, the transcripts of Hughes' memoirs, from some other source? I just don't know.
Mike, why is it that you or I acted that way, we'd be classed as certifiable paranoids. If you have $2 billion, you're simply eccentric. All of us who live in cities are choking in our own traffic. In America, the broad avenues and expensive freeways cannot keep pace with the public demand for more cars. In Europe, where there's just as much a demand for cars, things are even worse. The expansion of road systems is hampered. The past keeps getting in the way of road builders. Take Rome, for example. The center of the eternal city seems eternally choked with buses and cars and motorbikes. Romans refer to St. Peter's Square as the world's most majestic parking lot. An experiment to reduce the congestion by letting people ride city buses without charge proved a costly disaster. After one free bus ride, people started to bring in their cars again. A Roman can, if he gets up early enough, actually drive in his capital city.
Buongiorno a tutti. Buongiorno a voi romani. Iniziamo il nostro programma con un programma di musica.
If a Roman keeps more normal hours, he must creep like everyone else. To an Englishman, a car is his means of transport. To a Frenchman, it's said to be a battering ram. But to an Italian, well, let an Italian tell you about that. The most professional Roman of them all, Luigi Barzi.
I'm a Roman. I live in a city, this city, whose inhabitants consider it the cradle of civilization. It is surely the mother of law and of civilized behavior. At several times in its long history, it was threatened by barbarians. Today, a new barbarian is already within the city walls. Rubber barbarians, thousands and thousands of them, stampeding and mooing like wild bison, covering every foot of space. To jaywalk in Rome, you must have the steel nerves of a toreador. You must believe drivers are more afraid of killing you than you of dying. Most men still go home for lunch and siesta. Shops and offices close from 1 to 4. There are 4 peak hours, 4 traffic jams instead of 2. You argue with other drivers, you give them lessons from the safety of your seat.
Si guidano, si va, io sono in ritardo, che me ne frega. E che me ne frega di te? Ma metti un po' di olio, per carità. Gli stronzi che non finiscono mai.
But how can you use your hands, both hands, to emphasize and clarify the exact meaning of your thoughts?
Ma guarda un po'.
It's a shock to every Roman to find he's not the only driver on the road.
Maledetto, ma che fai?
In the war, Italians always made better pursuit pilots than bomber pilots. And what was true in war is also true in love. Prosperity. They want the car, then a fast car, a faster car, the fastest car on the road, preferably red. If Italians love beauty, is it surprising they built some of the sleekest, most terrifying missiles on the road? Are they designed only to travel faster? No. Really to be more desirable, sexy, to provoke the envy of lesser men. But nobody in Italy ever confesses to being an average man. Little men work at little jobs. What pleasure does Benito Fioravanti find as a Class B government functionary of the Etruscan Museum? Everybody persuades himself he's one of God's favored sons. Dreams are cheap. Wish fulfillments replace the dreariness of Benito's life. Surpassare means both to pass with an automobile and to surpass or excel socially, sexually, and politically. To be surpassato is to admit one's inferiority. The
because it is not when you arrive that counts, but what or whom you pass on the way. Never mind the laws. The laws exist for fools and the weak. They are tests of character and self-esteem for Benito. Consciously, Benito has all the normal male instincts. He's predatory and aggressive and would like to destroy his rival. Driving Italian style, there are really no more accidents in Rome than in any other large city. Maybe it's only make-believe. Life in Italy is often humiliating. One makes the best of it. One embellishes mediocre moments. One dreams of consoling compensations. Mangusta. Does it really exist? It's Benito's fantasy and hope. Reality overtakes Benito. Reality has only four small cylinders. Reality is also Rome's traffic nightmare, which is getting worse every day. The authorities can do little. I once proposed that all cars be banned from the center of Rome. It can't be done. It's like stopping the lava of Mount Etna with legal papers. We are all doomed. You too.
You are especially doomed if you live in what used to be called the Congo, now known as Zaire. They have a new punishment for traffic violators there. Death by the firing squad.
Dad thinks you're incredible the way you take care of all of us, Mom. With a house and a job, too.
I like him to think I'm incredible, honey.
So I take care of myself, too.
I exercise, eat right. And to make sure I get enough iron and vitamins, I
take Geritol every morning.
It's time for you to start taking it, too.
Geritol. More than twice the iron of ordinary supplements, plus seven vitamins. Take care of yourself. Take Geritol.
I hope I look as good as you when I grow up.
Apartment 3A thinks the way to keep a floor beautiful is to scrub and wax it. It's hard work. 3B's discovered a new, easy way to keep her floors looking beautiful, and she does it every time she damp mops.
When I damp mop, instead of a liquid cleaner and water, I use New Mop and Glow. It cleans and shines. I squeeze out New Mop and Glow, go over it with the damp mop, and the floor looks great.
Next time you damp mop, discover how New Mop and Glow cleans and shines.
60 Minutes will continue after station identification. This is CBS.
At W&J Sloan, discover the wonderful new world of contemporary furniture. Sloan's has a dramatic selection of the finest modern designs from famous makers. Sofas, lounge chairs, etagères, tables in striking bright lacquers, clear see-through glass, and fabrics that give a room a marvelous new perspective. Take advantage of substantial reductions during Sloan's store-wide sale. Fashion your own beautiful now living with W&J Sloan's modern new generation furnishings. See them all at your nearby Sloan store. Television 9.
This portion of 60 Minutes is sponsored by Good People to Do Business With, Employers Insurance of Warsaw.